take advantage of this energy while I got it. I had a ham and cheese croissant and some kombucha, and it just like lit a fire in me. I don't know what's going on.
I feel more
alive than I have in 2 weeks.
All right. Oh, hello.
Take this. Sorry. I was super ready until I realized that I had my earbuds clipped to my pocket. It was going to make a bunch of noise, so I moved it.
It's okay.
Okay. We're definitely good.
Okay. Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Heretic Hammer podcast. I am your host, Marshall, and this is my co-host, Dylan.
Hello.
And today, we're getting onerous. We're getting chivalric. We're getting feudal. That's right. Today, we're talking about... The Knights. But we're going to talk a little bit about both the Imperial and the Chaos Knights. The biggest reason for this is not because they're like so similar, despite that they kind of are, but it's actually also because most of the makeup of a Chaos Knight is in an Imperial Knight. That doesn't mean they won't get their due diligence in this discussion, but these aren't deep dives, so it's honestly just going to be pretty good to start as this, you know, knightly primer to bring them both in together.
Mm-hmm.
While we have talked about most playable factions in the game, right, for the tabletop, and that was kind of our baseline going into, you know, a lot of the, you know, first sets of episodes, you know, then we went through and, you know, we did our demo game. You know, we talked a little bit about building models, everything like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and we'll do our 1,000-point real game in the near future. Stick around and keep an eye on our YouTube page for posts about that. But there was one technical grouping that we did not talk about, and I discussed my reasons previously why we had not talked about the Knights before now and before kind of Dylan picked his faction. And that was because oftentimes, and this is, I'm not just doing this because I've heard this, I also agree with it, in that I've often heard that playing Knights in 40K is kind of like playing checkers against someone playing chess. That isn't to say that they make the game easier explicitly, or though they can be sometimes easier to start with in a sense, but that they're playing an almost different game in a sense, right? Like it's just, it's still 40K, right? You're still going to make a movement. You're going to shoot. You can charge. You'll make melee hits, but you are playing with not only significantly less models, but models that behave differently, right? You're not having infantry. You technically have a battle line unit, quote unquote, but you don't, they're not like Sisters of Battle or Imperial Guard or Pathfinder squads, you know, like they're just smaller knights, you know, but they still take a lot of wounds to destroy, and therefore, like I said, you are running much less models. However, we do have to talk about them, not only because obviously they are a playable army and they make for pretty solid, you know, allied units for many Imperial and Chaos armies, but because they're so freaking cool. Look at them. They're big mechs. What's not to like about them?
We've established that I like big mech.
Yes, exactly. And so do I. And thus, I want to talk about them. But first, we must talk about their origins a little bit. So back in the dark age of technology, knights were very much like farm and construction equipment. You know, the only artwork we'll ever see of them will have them with their guns and their weaponry. But, you know, when the you know, when humanity originally back then, you know, and this is 20K about, maybe even earlier than that, you know, you've got the, you know, colonizers heading out on their ships, and they would, you know, load off with all of these grandiose technology, and their ships were literally designed to be taken apart to construct this new society. This wasn't obviously going to leave them completely stranded forever. The idea was, upon taking apart the ship, you would then attain the capacity to then, you know, continue, then travel to the other planets nearby and do whatever needs to be done. But obviously, mm-hmm. the baseline being, you know, go off, unload this ship, take it apart, build society, then recoup, right? That was the plan, and it worked. And these, to aid in that effort, were essentially gigantic forklifts.
Now, did you have to be mech certified to operate them?
Well, absolutely you did. I mean, and this is the thing, right? Like, they, you know, as we'll talk about in a second, you know, these do take skill and mental fortitude to pilot. I mean, back then there probably were a number of things to assist in the matter, right? There were probably, you know, AI systems that helped work the systems, that, you know, obviously to help fix them, gauge them, target, all that stuff. Obviously, by the 40th millennium, you know, this has been completely removed. But at that point, there probably were things easier, but they still likely one way or another took a bit of mental fortitude that maybe they had more of then as well. But obviously at a time, you know, they found themselves cut off as the age of strife begins. And after fighting, you know, or in need to fight both the AI betrayers and then the multiple Xenos threats that would face many worlds of throughout the, what was then the former, you know, imperial human settlements. Because, I mean, it's kind of like an empire since they were technically conquering each of these worlds in a way. We don't, again, mm-hmm. know to the extent back then. But, yeah, like they would, you know, still have to face these Xenos threats that would still plague them from whatever, whether they be even like Drakari, orcs, or the many that became extinct during the Great Crusade. And so the giant walking mechs that were once your forklifts and cranes now have the perfect platforms to put guns on and help defend yourself, because nothing else is, you know, there is no communicating with our allies of the rest of humanity. We need something now, and this, we can put this gun on this mech.
Right. Yep, just slap it on there and be ready to go.
Right. So over time, these machines, on especially the worlds that they remained on, because there are obviously plenty where they were destroyed completely, where they, you know, were eliminated, they, you know, or just like the entire civilization itself was, you know, taken out. But the ones that, you know, effectively used these, they became revered. You know, over time, in millennia that went by, you know, the culture of these worlds very much reflected and became a part of these, you know, like, or surrounding these knights as they eventually became. So, and so much so that, you know, they would eventually rise to be looked at as like the nobles and lords and kings of these worlds. And therefore we clearly see the superiority of being forklift certified.
Mm-hmm.
Because when society collapses, we're going to need and worship those who have the certification to pilot such machinery. But that was the thing, right? And then as part of the de-evolution of a lot of these worlds, a lot of these night worlds, as they are kind of now known, stayed in a generally very feudal state. You know, that's the thing, right? A lot of, like, especially a lot of agricultural worlds or even just various ones in general, if they did, you know, maintain a lot of the planet's greenery, a lot of them just kind of ended up, you know, devolving society into being almost very medieval. And so these defenders then, and the societies took these defenders and kind of wrapped into that almost holistically. So they became almost this like mix of like being this medieval, like something straight out of a D&D book, but then like a mech walks through.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and it's just like, and then like, you know, like all of a sudden these spaceships come rearing down from the sky, and then this giant mech comes and just blasts them out. You know, like this is how they worked. So they weren't like completely devoid of technology, right? Like, even though a lot of these planets and their farmers, for example, if they were like a somewhat of like an agricultural night world, like they would still mine and farm very much with like their, you know, with very hand used tools. Now, maybe would, you know, could they be using like a weed whacker or a tractor? Maybe, sure, but it depends. It's not to say, because a lot of times you'll see in artwork that people make, they'll obviously utilize like as if the world is completely a medieval and then there's just this mech over there, you know, and that is a possibility, but there is some mixings, right? Like there is obviously the possibility for them to be able to communicate with and have like communication devices and stuff like that. And some of them may keep that to the noble houses and then have the peasantry be, you know, in that totally medieval state. And many people are fine with that. That's the thing, right? Because inevitably they are still taken care of. Just because they live a simple life doesn't mean that they are treated much like maybe some would be in a hive world. You know, they have their homes, they get fed, they till their crops, they move their soil, they essentially about as happy probably as anybody in that, like a farmer or whatnot, would have been even in a feudal society, maybe without as much of the black plaguing. Not always, but sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Things happen, you know. Nurgle's out there. He's got to do his own thing. You know, he's got to bring the plague to somewhere.
Yeah. Got to put it somewhere.
But yeah, so these night worlds, you know, are just this mix. So you'll still see like they will always have like these big castles, but they'll even have mines. Like these worlds are almost just like holistic worlds. Like you'll see a hive world, right? And that is purely a city, like a giant city, you know, like Coruscant in Star Wars. Or you'll have an agri world, yeah. And it's explicitly all farmland. And the only type of city function is like essentially just wherever the noble is of that world, or that kind of barons over it, but otherwise is just kind of chilling. You know, they're just doing the politics with the Imperium, and then all the farmers just take their gigantic tractors and just, you know, farm over, you know, acres and acres of crop. And you know, and it goes on. These are universal. Like they have everything that a normal planet that is in this state would do. So they'll mine, mm-hmm. they'll farm, you know, they'll build whatever, you know, formation of industry that maybe they have. Many of these night worlds were within this realm. And then obviously, eventually, 30K comes along, the Imperium arrives, they're like, hello, we're the Imperium. We're here to help you. Join us and give, and you know, bring your mechs with you, and we'll let you continue your success. So actually, funny enough, in these night worlds, you actually find yourself with a pretty solid amount of autonomy. Pretty much all you got to do is every now and then the Imperium needs some help, you send your knights along. They'll travel over and they'll go to war. And honestly, many of people in these knightly houses pretty okay with that. They're
a sweet deal.
Yeah, I mean, they're the thing is, and we'll get to that in a second, like, they're very attached to their knights. They have a very kind of symbiotic relationship with their knights, and their knights do like to go to war. So thus, mm-hmm. so do they. Now, they're not barbaric in this in that sense, because knights, much like a knight, has a code of chivalry, honor, and duty to protect those that need protecting. That was the basis of what these knights were had existed. They exist today, and their worlds exist today because they defended the people of their worlds, and they view doing that for the Imperium to be the same thing. And thus, joining the Imperium and protecting a wider galaxy and their people seemed like a very fitting thing to do for an honorous knight.
Mm-hmm.
So, obviously, then, in terms of the tithes or the payments that they have to give to the Imperium, obviously, outside of just coming to help, they also will, you know, obviously help out with, like, the Agra World part. They don't take more than, like, as much as they would take from, say, an Agra World, because they obviously still intend, like, the lords and kings and queens of these Night Worlds still intend to take care of their people to keep it going. But they will still pay the Imperium in these minerals and crops to help. And then obviously the knights is the big thing. It's the very clear yes, and definitely. Obvious huge benefit are these gigantic war machines, you know, because it's great that they can give some crops. But the Imperium is honestly just generally thankful to have the assistance of gigantic war machines, because really for the Imperium's goals, not much is more helpful than that. You know, even this thing is probably even better than 1,000 guardsmen to the Imperium. Like, it is just like, oh, sweet. We have a knight. Awesome. That's like Christmas. So as members of the Imperium, then, as years went by, they found themselves essentially then in three camps of Imperial Knights. And this was the Questoris Imperialis, the Questoris Mechanicus, and Freeblades. So Imperialis Knights are sworn to the Imperium itself. They have essentially retained the lordship over their worlds. They have the normal freedoms to run them as they had the pleasure to, and essentially have the focus of their tithes to, you know, do their trading, but then also to defend the Imperium as a whole, right? Like, they will go out, they will travel wherever they are destined to or told to kind of go help with, protect themselves, protect their neighbors, whatever it may be, right? They are essentially, but they are still, though, their houses. So they will have the heraldry. You'll see on any of these images of knights, you know, they have these imagery colorings that are very distinct. And this is of their houses. You know, they are there to represent, we are house blank, and we are here to, you know, I am here to represent this house, this prince, this lordship, this king, this queen, and I am here to bring judgment to you.
Attention, Orc! You face Lord Horik Kanorum, son of High King Valerik Kanorum, High Prince of House Kanorum, Master of the Blade of Gaia, Keeper of the Gates of Loralo, Wielder of the Caloric Flame, Bringer of Hope, Herald of the Holy Order of the Adamantine Lance, the Paladin of Koto, Slayer of the Lion of Essa, the Triumphant, the Light of Stars, the Eradicator.
Nice. Excellent.
That's his whole title. I wish.
Is there a limit?
Of
or
what,
is it
titles?
Just like you? Yeah. Could you theoretically just have infinite titles because screw you?
I mean, anything in 40K could tactically lead to that. Yes.
Yeah. If you hang around long enough.
Yeah, but like, and obviously that is also an exaggeration because it's a game from the entire, you know, perspective of an orc, right? But it's also not far off, right? Because again, many would look at this concept as being pompous, right? Like that they are, you know, trying to tell their tales and all that and whatever. But that's the thing, right? To them, the honor of who they are, who they represent, what they have done is important. It is their lifeline. Their deeds are surrounded by the, you know, what they have accomplished in their lives. So, yes, it is in a way very pompous. But again, it's kind of like read the room, you know? Like, when your whole society and all of 40K is essentially about the deeds you have committed in war, then it inherently shows a distinct amount of, you know, of importance to somebody's personal, you know, pride and livelihood to indicate what you have done in said wars. But there are also another type of knights called the Mechanicus, or Questoris Mechanicus, as we talked about, or as I said, and they are purely devoted to the priests of Mars. And so the Mechanicus and their forge worlds, and thus are often then protectors and will often be based in those forge worlds. So while they do give up much of their autonomy from the night worlds and whatnot, they gain the first pickings of technology, weapons, repairs. So like they're always in the best shape, and, you know, their knights are going to put, you know, they're just going to be always the most put together. Now, they're going to generally have given up the maybe original housing that they had prior to the Great Crusade, but they have adapted themselves. They have adopted a new house that indicates the fact that they are not only a house, but they are a house of the Omnisaya. Right. So they will have the cog. You'll see, you know, imagery. They'll often be red, you know, like the robes of the Mechanicus. They are a part of the Mechanicus. And then you have free blades, those who have, for one reason or another, forsaken their houses or given up attachment to them for essentially a life of wandering war. Now, these are not traitors or renegades. That is a very clear statement with this. They are still incredibly loyal to the Imperium, and they still wish to protect and honor the Imperium itself and hold their own honor. They are just leavers of the house that they were once a part of, right? So some, for example, might have lost their house or entire world to maybe an invasion, you know, a planetary disaster happened, whatever it may be, their house or planet is gone and they have none to return to. And thus they will just go throughout the Imperium doing what they can, or maybe even try to see what they can do to help rebuild the honor of their house in some way. Not likely, but that's like their maybe like goal. Like they'll have this thought in their mind.
Yeah.
Especially because if they're, you know, the last of their house, they technically could find a new planet, do something with that, and like build their house up or something. But not likely. Otherwise, others can attempt to fulfill a personal duty that they feel is beholden to their honor, right? They will not be able to idly serve their house because they have maybe like to fight this enemy. They have to go find this enemy, or somebody has disgraced them, you know, or a legion has a whole army has disgraced them, and they have to go find them and attain their revenge or get somebody back or find someone who is lost that they were swore to protect. Something like that. They have to go out and get them. Otherwise, they cannot holistically be a part of the house anyway because their honor has been tainted. So they are going to go out and find them or defeat them. And obviously, they can't necessarily go back because most who become a free blade are never returning. So, but they feel that like they've already failed, so they must go do this anyway.
I was curious about that, if it was like once you go free yes. blade status if you can ever return, or if it's considered like, nope, you're free blade forever.
Yeah, pretty much. It is. You are free blade forever. You know, like I said, like maybe there's some instances where they could, but generally, especially for, you know, especially for these, the, you know, either your house is already gone or you just choose to leave, which is not taken lightly, by the way, you know, mm-hmm. but like you choose to leave, you're leaving. The only maybe one that could technically slot you back in is some free blades are just marooned or abandoned. Like maybe they thought they were shut down, but then, you know, they were going to come out of the wreckage and they're like, hey, where'd everybody go? You know, so you might then, when the Imperium kind of rears back around at some point, you know, are like, oh, well, shoot, you're here. Oh, we thought you died. Well, it's good. You could just hop along and help us out. And then maybe you can, you know, get your way back. Like, maybe that's the scenario where, like, you could, because, like, you technically didn't choose to leave, right? You were abandoned or you were marooned. Your ship crash landed onto this planet. And obviously the Imperial will the Imperium will ask for your help while you are traveling with them. Mm-hmm. And you are technically a free blade in that instance, but I can't necessarily see that, like, you would explicitly be banished from your house, but I'm sure plenty would. So, because it's obviously a harsh universe. So, you know, that is kind of what it is. But yeah, so like, just for whatever reason, you may need to be a free blade. You may be a, you know, a Forge World knight, or you will be, you know, an Imperial knight. This is kind of up to whatever it is that your house has decided. But let's talk about, you know, what are the knights exactly? More importantly, what are the types of knights? Because they have their small little function. So knights themselves, all knights, are all bipedal, and they generally share a similar form and shape, and they are piloted through something called the Throne Mechanicum. And this is essentially a, you know, gigantic chair, which actually, and so the Throne Mechanicum is like a chair that the knight is held in. So as a reminder also, like, while the mechs are called knights as well, the true knight is the pilot within. Yes. And this seat is very much like an invasive thing. You are not just sitting in this chair looking at a screen and just turning the knobs and dials and levers. You are still doing those things, but you are also interfacing with the machine spirit of the knight itself. And when a knight first interacts with the machine itself, it is kind of said to me much like trying to, like, wrangle and corral a wild horse, you know. And some may be more erratic and temperamental than others, but all in all, you are going to sit in this chair and just do a mind battle with the machine spirit, as essentially it gauges whether or not you're even worthy to pilot it.
Okay.
Yeah, so, like, some people die in this process. Like, the machine spirit will just be like, fuck you, and just explode your brains.
Wow. Just, nope, you're not worthy. Yep. You've chosen poorly, and just pop it. Yeah, Are you familiar with the game series Zone of the Enders?
I'm familiar with it, yes. I have not played it in forever.
From one Hideo Kojima.
Yeah, it in fact is actually a game that in some respect... like, was one of those, I wouldn't say, like, it scarred me, because I never looked at it, like, giving nightmares, but that opening cutscene was something, it was, like, one of those things where, like, it stayed in my head as, like, this just, like, I remember that creepy, like, cutscene in that game where, like, the mech falls on these kids, like...
Oh, yeah.
I was like, damn, that's fucked up.
Yeah. Oh, the whole, both games have a lot going on. I bring it up because in the second game, the second runner, the main character Dingo, he is put into the mech Jehudi as a form of life support after he gets shot.
Yeah.
So it's a case of like he is bound and like connected to the mech on the inside. And if you were to leave the mech, it would effectively kill him because it's the thing that's actually keeping him alive in the first place.
Yes. And that is not particularly the same case in this, where it's similar, but like I said before, they're forming a very symbiotic relationship, but the knight is obviously able to still disconnect, get out of the mech and, you know, do whatever they need to do. Right. Like, especially if they are like a king or queen or some type of high lord, they're going to need to do things. But often those who pilot mechs, you know, feel like, and the knight mechs themselves feel, you know, incomplete when they are not within them. You know, they
Phantom
are
limb.
The most comfortable. Can you feel? they feel like they're at home oftentimes when they're with their knight. They like, and the knight generally then, which is why when getting a new pilot, you know, is such a process for them, that Machine Spirit almost similarly also kind of has this feeling and connection to its pilot, right? So that's why it's so like tied to each other.
Sure.
Now, we do have, though, different types of knights. The first type of knight themselves is called an armiger. And armigers are actually small knights. So in terms of, I don't know, like, essentially they're about the half the size of the full-sized knight.
Mm-hmm.
And these armigers are piloted differently than the big knights. So they actually just have a helm mechanicum. And this completely binds them to a nearby larger knight. Now, somebody can pilot an armiger without being nearby another knight, but they often are. And the kind of complicated part about this is that this is not just like a communication or like a relaying device. This is a full mind control device.
Oh.
Those in armigers that are in a nearby knight being controlled are fully controlled. This is like just complete body takeover. And obviously, this doesn't always go over super well with those that go into armigers. Not everybody is immediately keen on this. So proper and kind of good knight worlds and knight houses will do their due diligence on trying to make sure not only that it's very clear this is what's going to happen, but also that, you know, they are going to, you know, that like they are loyal to the house and the person that they are going to be with. Because that's the thing, right? Like if you're trying to maybe like move your way up a ladder, it can seem really invasive and lame to have to essentially be somebody's, you know, just puppet. But these are essentially kind of like serfs, right, to a knight. They're going to often then be very loyal followers who will, you know, who are okay with following the control and command of the, you know, their knight superior and will go along with it. Now, obviously, plenty of armigers do go freeblade, but that is to say, though, plenty don't. It's just kind of dependent on your personality, mostly. But there are a few types of these armigers. So there is the Halverin, which is meant to like lay down blistering hails of fire, of heavy fire, and are somewhat able to get a little bit closer. So you'll kind of see them, you know, with their... Oh, sorry. I'm thinking the other one. These ones are the ones who actually be farther away. Sorry. So you'll see they're the ones with these two guns. They will have these kind of long auto cannons, and they may have a melta or auto or like stubber on the top, but they're generally going to keep at a relative range. And then you have your warglaive, which is going to have a chainsword and a thermal spear, or essentially just a gigantic double melta gun.
I like it.
Generally, obviously, like I said, will get up close and personal and very good against vehicles. However, there's one more which is very uncommon, which is the Moirax. And this is generally out of production because it was very unstable. It used a power unit that was like just very volatile. And they would just often either completely pitter out or blow up. But they would use heavier weapons like big plasma, Volkite weapons, which are also very rare now. The Volkite one, not the plasma. But yep. So they are somewhat a part of a bygone era into the Imperium. The other two, much more stable, much more versatile, and therefore much more widely used. And then we have the Questoris frame of knight. This is the one you'll see the most commonly, and it has, therefore, the most types that you will find. And the big thing generally that will change the type of knight, or at least Questoris knight, that it is what is just the armament of them. You know, most of these Questoris knights are all going to seem pretty much similar. It's just whatever guns they're carrying. Now, obviously, in lore, you know, if you told one knight versus another that, like, you're essentially the same, you just have different guns, they'd blow you to bits for saying such, you know, dishonoring to them. But realistically, that's just it. It's just they're the same frame with different guns. They just have a bunch of names because they're knights. But the first type is a crusader. They are generally going to have two guns. This could be varied. You know, this could be between, you know, two, like, essentially, you know, two, like, essentially, like, two chain cannons or, like, mini guns, essentially. You know, they could have like a melta gun in one and the chain cannon in another. They could have a big, you know, a big auto cannon, kind of much like the, you know, their Halveran little cousins. They will always kind of have two gun arms. And the biggest thing about them is because they're big on being able to be supportive. And, you know, obviously there may be knights that prefer to get up close, but that does not mean that they get disrespected for being far away, because their biggest benefit is that they want to kill whatever is coming to their allies before it reaches them.
Mm.
That's like their whole aim and objective. Otherwise, then you have your knight errant. So they are much more designed to generally want to fight like other big creatures or whatever. They will often utilize thermal cannons, which are, again, just big melta guns. And they will also utilize some type of melee arm, whether this be a gigantic chain blade. Some of them will have like essentially like a big claw or fist.
Nice.
Or somewhat other similar ones. Otherwise, they are going. There's also the Knight Gallant. I'm going to kind of blast through some of these because there's a good number of them. And this isn't a deep dive, as I mentioned. Mm-hmm. Knight Gallants are generally melee type knights. They will have both melees, like arms, one in each, and often generally will have like a Reaper Chainsword and a Thunderstrike Gauntlet, kind of. That 1-2, or they'll have both of each. It's kind of just dependent on what they're feeling.
Yeah.
And then this one I think is also kind of rare, but there's the Knight Megara. I think I'm pronouncing this correctly. But they are like your shock assault knight. They'll have a melee arm, so either with like the claw, the fist, chainsword, whichever it may be. And then a gun arm, but one that will be like a lightning cannon, which is just this gigantically powerful, like generally a lesser used weapon in the current Imperium, as it very much kind of fits with. The big thing about this is that this was a model of knight that was in Forge World, so like old.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So like, okay. But is the whole thing of like utilizing this just like gigantic like plasma and like essentially like wielding lightning. Otherwise, one of the most onerous of knights, kind of looked at as like by often they will be like this will be piloted by the highest of knight within this class. Because as we kind of go up in this list, it'll kind of be like more the higher and higher the noble, the like the knight sits on the noble ladder. So this one is like the one that would be the highest of this class, of the Questoris class. and that's the Knight Paladin. So very archetypal. They will have, you know, maybe a giant rapid fire battle cannon or a heavy stubber. They'll then also have a melee arm. But the big thing about them is just their mindset. For them, it's the biggest difference, really, because we've obviously had one range, one melee weaponed knights in the past. Their biggest thing is going to generally be either having somewhat better armor, subgun, and like subguns. Like many of them will have like missile units on the tops of the knight carapace. They'll have slightly better versions of those and like technically better armor. And the basis on that is the data sheet has just slightly better save and toughness and wounds compared to some of the other ones, and thus it's more points as well.
Yeah,
for the game. Then there is the Knight Preceptor. These generally in culture are trainers and arms masters. They will often have a Laz Impulsor and then a melee arm. Its chest may have a multi-laser, which there is a character that actually has this weapon, which we'll talk about in a bit. But yes, so they but yes, they're often kind of going to be your elder ones, but ones that more especially train younger knight pilots. Okay, then we got two more. We got the Knight Styrix, essentially just designed for, you know, war and slaughter. They have a melee arm, which is the chainsword or claw. They often will have an inbuilt rad cleanser.
What, sorry?
Yeah. I think this one is one of the old models because this has a Volkite Chevrolet. I don't know if I pronounced this correctly.
Chevrolet? What?
Yeah. It has a Volkite, you know, weapon, which generally means it's from the Heresy because Volkite weaponry is making its way back into the Imperium now that Kahl is around. But they are still not widely used because they are a rare commodity now, where they are way more utilized in the Horus Heresy Great Crusade time. And then finally, we have a Knight Warden, which again is another close combat specialist. They love to rush in, but they will use both melee and ranged weapon, but that will generally be some type of like Gatling cannon or heavy flamer. So weapons that do benefit to be close ranged. And that's the Questoris Knights.
Nice. Okay.
Like I said, they are the most common.
Quite the list.
And thus, there's a lot of them. Next up, you have your Sarastis Knight class. They are the newest to the tabletop, in a sense. This is very quotation mark. The background to that quotation mark is knights were somewhat originally brought to tabletop in Warhammer's epic scale of 40k, which was essentially all the models were really smaller, like were really small, but like one unit, like one model would be like, would have like, for example, would have like 12 miniature guardsmen on it, right? That would be like the size of like a Necron Scarab to like normal 40k. And so like a knight would be the size of like a Space Marine model. Right, like that's how they would scale this. And so that was how these originally were showcased. So they're the oldest when it comes to lore then, or one of the oldest when it comes to lore. I can't say the oldest because they are all technically made around the same time. But they were around in lore for a long time, but got a refreshed plastic model, and they were in Forge World 2, but they got a refreshed plastic model, technically designed for Horus Heresy, but you can run them in 40K, just fine, in plastic last couple years, I want to say. I can't remember when the first of the Serastus Knights came out for Horus Heresy, but the current edition of Horus Heresy is only a couple years old, so it... At least at the oldest, I think, is 2022. And Knights themselves as a faction is only as old as 6th edition for 40K normal sized. So, hence why I said, like, it's very mixed. But Serastus Knights are the newest models to have come out. And, personally, one of my favorites. I actually really like them. They're kind of mixed bag. Some people don't like the tall lankiness that they have. I love them. I think they're cool. But they have a couple of different ones. So they have the Knight Acheron, designed to engage foes at close range with heavy flamers and chain swords. So again, both a ranged and chain sword type. You have the Knight Atropos, which is... The only thing it necessarily gives me is that they're designed to combat Heretic and Xenos war engines. This is a Forge. This was an old Forge World one. It had what was called a Graviton Singularity Cannon.
Okay.
Which, first of all, it's a gun that essentially shoots, like, that fucks with gravity. And that's all I got really about it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, like, it is a fuck you and everything around you kind of gun. Like I said, not generally seen around now. Then there is the Knight Castigator, designed generally to take down hordes of lesser foes with its Castigator bolt cannon. Otherwise, it will also have... and this is essentially just like a twin minigun thing. It's like very... In a way, it's like kind of goofy and silly, but it will have both like a sword, like a power sword looking thing, and then this like chain thing. It can technically, I think, also be fitted with like a twin melta gun as well. But it's just known for the essentially weird stubbed dual minigun. And then finally, the Knight Lancer, which will have essentially just as designed for melee combat. It will have a Serastus Shock Lance, which is a essentially big lance that will essentially shoot out a bolt of lightning as it tries to pierce something. And then an Ion Gauntlet Shield. So all knights will have an Ion Shield, which is essentially a directional shield of energy that the pilot will direct in whatever direction they sense that they're getting shot from. This takes that essentially just a step further and is just like essentially a literal shield that it will use to just like use its arm to deflect melee attacks with.
Huh.
Similarly, it's my favorite of the Serastus Knights because
yeah.
A knight with a literal shield and lance is cool as hell. And I love it. And then we have the Dominus Knight class. See how short that list was? and these are going to have, especially now, or especially in modern 40K, we'll have generally the most noble of the households, the higher tiered members of each noble class or knight house or whatever. If they have them, they will pilot these. And they're much beefier, taller, and... therefore more filled with more armor and more guns. These ones generally will always be double gunned. So what makes them different is generally just based on what guns they use. So there are two that we'll go over, and that is the Knight Castellan. They're generally aimed at destroying enemies at a very long range. So they are going to be armed with a Volcano Lance, which is a more impressive name than what it is. It is a heavy laser weapon. And it just has a really good long range. And essentially, it's just one giant laser that will shoot out.
Yeah.
But then also the plasma decimator, which is much more impressive, which is equally as impressive as its name implies, which will just is just a, essentially a gigantic plasma gun that has two cores and will just essentially blast a hole in whatever the hell you point it at. And then we have the Knight Valiant. So this is meant to be a little bit closer in range, and it will utilize the Thunder Coil Harpoon, which is not only a harpoon in and of itself to pierce and drag enemies closer, but mm-hmm. will also then release an electrical charge to then stun and damage said thing it pierced into.
Big boy taser.
Yeah, well, big boy taser harpoon.
Right.
And then, where'd you go? And then we'll also have a conflagration cannon.
Okay.
Which is three Melta guns together.
Why one when you can three?
Yep. And then we'll also similarly either have big missiles on its back, you know, large, like heavy cannons, or all more or twin Melta guns, because you can't right. have the solution to more
Never
Melta
enough.
Is, yeah, the solution to your problem can always be more Melta.
Mm-hmm.
And so finally, there is technically the Acastus Knights, which are borderline small titans, and they are again similarly going to always be ranged. They're pretty much unseen at this point. They generally wielded Volkite weapons, but as far as I knew, they were the most unstable. They are obviously really crazy to try to transport, you know, because you're essentially bringing a small titan with you.
Yeah.
So I think this is about the size of a Stompa. And therefore, it doesn't seem to really be on the radar of anyone in the Imperium or Games Workshop. This is a Forge World model, and it seems to be content to die along with it.
Okay.
And honestly, from a points standpoint, like, because you can technically still run them, they're not generally worth doing either, because we've kind of all realized that the Dominus class is kind of the maximum amount you want for points in your Knight Army, because otherwise then you're just going to have too few models. But as I alluded to at the beginning of this episode, some of these knights did in fact fall to chaos. And you may be wondering, why do so? Well, multiple reasons. In fact, as with Space Marines, many of the houses also chose to follow the path of War Master Horus for various reasons.
Oh, sure.
Some may have saw the honor in Horus's goals. Some maybe similarly wanted to follow along the path of the Dark Mechanicus, or even just seeing chaos as a way to get what they want. Now, others then along this path then may have ended up generally just going insane, as the stress of communing with the machine spirit is often too much of a task for some people, and thus they end up kind of falling into the dark powers. And thus then, those chaos powers infuse themselves into the knight and its machine spirit. Some of which just being controlled by a demon, essentially, at this point, all on its own.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a couple of aspects to it. So there are fallen knight worlds that exist throughout the galaxy, and they generally will have, cultists, fallen nobles, just essentially just trying to raise the greatest fanes to the ruinous powers, right? So these often are going to be called iconoclast houses. They are those who have just essentially fallen to chaos as a household and just either worship the gods or a specific god, and generally have abandoned the sense of honor and chivalry and just look for conquest. They want to just make their house known and conquer those in the name of their house.
Yeah.
These are ones that will generally also though have like kept some of their like their sanity and their togetherness with, you know, the like they are still pilots to a machine. They're just a little more cuckoo. That doesn't mean that all of them have plenty of their armager class, which are called war dogs, are just thralls or just demon thralls essentially at this point. Right. Plenty of them are no longer people in those things. But there are those who have not just completely, you know, become interred to their machine. But that is to say, there are some of these who are not demons and not, but in between, where they're just holistically interred to the machine, where like they cannot escape it. They are stuck in it. Because the night will not let them leave. Otherwise, there are infernal houses who are similarly to Questor's Mechanicus houses, are infernal to or are loyal to the Dark Mechanicum, and otherwise serve very similarly to the Questor's Mechanicus, just for the Dark Mechanicum. And these are often ones that will then be interred or demons into the night. You know, these will often not be ones who are going to ever leave this night. nor would honestly many of them who serve the Dark Mechanicus want them to. They also then have free blades. They're called Dread Blades, but essentially they're the same thing. These will often be demons straight up at that point, but then also just be any sort of Chaos Knight. Otherwise, most Chaos Knights, the reason that we're bringing this up now is just because they have the same size and loadouts as many of their Imperial counterparts. Now, they do have a couple of their own units, one of which being the Knight Abominant, which utilizes not only this giant Volkite cannon, but have these electrical tendrils that they use to fight along the, you know, I mean, honestly, the short, what's it called? A Broken Blade has a good kind of visual example of how the Knight Abominant utilizes these things. I mean, they can pierce right in through the armor. They could try to essentially, especially when they're fighting another knight, they can go right to where they know that pilot is going to be sitting, just pierce through in and try to, you know, get them at the source. Because many Chaos Knights know that they could, you know, their pilot could be pierced. They'll be fine. They have the dark powers to keep them alive or keep at least the night going. Otherwise, you will also find them with plenty of Chaos Space Marines and doing whatever witch that they go to. So Iron Warriors love their knights, obviously. And, you know, they will do as they wish to, you know, and doing whatever it is that they are tasked to do with said, you know, Chaos Space Marine unit or whatnot, or whatever the War Master of Abaddon asks them to do. The Knight Abominant is the newest, is like kind of Chaos Knight edition, and they are definitely my favorite of the Chaos Knights for sure. Because it's just a really cool thing, and it's got all these birds on top. Like, what's not to love about birds?
We love birds.
And I love like the tusk, like helmet, like head.
I thing do too. Too. The tusks are really cool.
Well, and that's why I love
the ridging on the inside of them. Like, that's really cool.
Oh, they're wonderfully detailed. That's why this is a great model. And that's also though why I love Chaos Terminators. Chaos Space Marine Terminators will have the like tusks on their Terminator masks, and I just think that's super cool. But yeah, so let's talk about a couple characters. I'm going to talk about two specifically, though there is one Chaos Knight of note that I think is super cool. I can't remember his name at the moment. Someone could put it in the comments. He is super fucking cool because this whole thing is essentially that like it is just a straight up demon at this point, like demon engine at this point, pretty much. And he it will be summoned essentially if there is enough death and pools of blood on a battlefield that it could just summon him and he will just show up and just start killing everything.
You meet the quota.
There's enough blood quota here. It's like that villain from Courage the Cowardly Dog that like comes up from puddles. So if there's enough water, she'll appear. You know, it's like that, but blood. But first, I want to talk about a notable knight of Imperial Knights, and that is Hector Cerberin. I actually don't exactly know how to pronounce his name, but he's a Freeblade Knight piloting Canis Rex, and is obviously, as denoted, if it's a knight that you know its name, that means it is important. And it is one that has, this is one that has the Thunderstrike Gauntlet, which is it's called Freedom's Hand. It essentially is just a gigantic plasma lance. So it's a fine-tuned plasma beam that can obviously then also be stabbed into something. So you can just stab into it and then blast through it like a DBZ fight. Hector's house was invaded by Iron Warriors, and the house was completely destroyed. A number of him and his other fellow knights attempted a last stand. However, many of them were either broken down and turned traitor, and the house itself essentially became a complete traitor house and went full Chaos Knight, except for him. Okay, 1 second. Cap is calling me. Mm-hmm. Hello.
Hi, is there time?
No, I'm still recording. I'm almost done, though.
Right.
So I'll call you back when I'm done.
Okay. All
right.
Quick, I'm heading home, but please call me back.
Okay,
sounds
good. All right, bye. All right. She just said no, I wasn't done yet.
Okay.
So, yes. So, so he was, because he remained loyal, he was put prisoner. However, because all of their knights got disabled by the Iron Warriors. However, Canis Rex returned itself back on, got up, found Hector, freed him, and they escaped together.
Nice.
So now he is the only loyal person of his house proper, and searches the galaxy, essentially attempting to free citizens from chaos and protect them from those who would inter them into, you know, essentially acts of dishonor. He's actually one of the few knights where you can actually get a little model of him too, which is fun. It doesn't really do much of anything, but he's got a model technically. And then for our proper Chaos Knight to talk about, we're going to talk about, this isn't going to be a picture of him, but there isn't one. and that is of Death's Saber. So it is a Knight Rampager, who after nearly 2.5 centuries of ceaseless war has been covered in a thick layer of skin and fat. Just taken from worthy foes. Yeah, that's pretty gross. So at some point, though, this as being looked at as this bastion of chaos power, it started getting this like a bunch of chaos followers just kind of started following him around. You know, these cultists would just kind of be like following it on the battlefield, being like, yes, look at the glory of chaos. Look at the dark god's will. And they just followed around. Yeah. However, at some point, this slaughter and skin taking drew the admiration of a pack of Necron flayed ones who subsequently emerged, killed the cultists, and then started worshiping Death Saber as they saw the flesh covered in it as a manifestation of the Catan they serve called Landegor. So essentially seeing it essentially as a giant flayed one.
You right? worship this, I worship this.
And the funniest part of the whole thing is because it's just so murder crazy, it has no idea that those cultists that were once following it are now Xenos worshippers.
Right.
So you just have this Chaos Knight covered in flesh, just rampaging through the galaxy, killing things at whim, followed by mind for flayed Necron flayed ones that it doesn't even notice or pay any attention to.
Wow.
It's just killing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I just love it. It's so 40K, you know?
Right. Yeah, the dramatic irony of it all.
Yeah, and it's the perfect grimderp, you know? Of just mm-hmm. like, you know, it's crazy slaughter, and it's like obviously like a horror to the thought and mind, and would be a horror of the eyes. But like, it's just goofy enough to make you chuckle. And that's the big lowdown on Knights, to be honest.
Cool.
There's not a whole lot else for me to really bring in outside of getting real deep. But, you know, what questions do you have on Knights?
I don't know if I really have any. It was pretty thorough on that.
Yeah, I mean, this, by the way, this, the Chaos, which is the Chaos Knights cover of their 9th edition codex, is one of my favorites because looking at it, you have this Chaos Knight, you know, saw blading into a dreadnought. And then while sawing into this dreadnought, looking over to the ultramarines next to it, like, yeah. just like, I don't, yeah. like, I'm too big and powerful to care about this dreadnought. What the fuck are you guys doing?
Listen, if y'all want to run, I'll look the other way.
Well, and that's the funny part. I should talk a little bit about the tabletop. I didn't really do that. So,
yeah, that's true. Yeah.
The baseline of the Imperial Knights is their whole thing is this bondsman ability, which in its original intent is kind of meant to essentially, as kind of noted with the lore, to bind, you know, like essentially have your big knight follow a set of little knights. Right. So like you have your questors with your armigers and then kind of have them benefit each other in some capacity. Right. Like you are, you know, by having your bondsman nearby you, you have someone benefit. And this rule is called Code Chivalric. So. They get kind of this benefit where at the end of the beginning of their command phases, they will essentially get like these objectives or oaths deed or oaths. And when they complete them, they will gain command points, the ability to do or to get certain buffs, stuff like that. The bondsman thing itself got nerfed. So the big thing about the knights now is just following these oaths and deeds. But they still get a decent amount of benefits, right? Like, so if they get an oath, you know, called Lay Low the Tyrant, you know, where if you destroy the enemy warlord, you know, you can re-roll a hit roll and a wound roll, which is obviously always beneficial because those ones are a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
And certain other things. The other benefit you get as well is because you are vehicles, you get the benefit, and this is true for Chaos Knights too, is A, you can coolly mad your way through walls, so cover doesn't have to mean as much all the time. And then also that you can shoot in melee. you don't have to worry about like needing a pistol because you're a vehicle. And all vehicles have the capacity to shoot when in engagement range or within 1 inch of a model. Chaos Knights, or Chaos Knights, I should say, put the emphasis on the wrong thing. Their whole thing is the battle shock function of 40K, which we didn't really go over too much in our demo. Mm-hmm. I kind of forgot about it because honestly, much of the game forgets about battle shock because it barely matters. The big thing about battle shock is you cannot use your command points for anything on that unit, and it has an objective control of zero. So if something is battle shocked, essentially you are not holding that objective. If you're contesting an objective, and then you fail your battle shock, you will lose that objective.
Oh, okay.
But so Chaos Knights themselves then focus very much on trying to find every way possible to make you roll and fail your battle shocks, which, as I kind of said, is only half useful because, like, sure, making your opponent have OC zero is good for scoring points, but it doesn't do much more than that. Yes, they can't command reroll that unit. Again, very good. But you're not making them roll less. You're not making their AP less. You're not making them, you know, there's abilities and enhancements to do those things, but it's not in the army ability, right? And there's not extra abilities to help do that. So it's like one of those things where it's just like, it technically does something, but it doesn't. And thus the like, or at least not like as much as you wish it would. And thus you kind of have two weird states of knights right now with tabletop. For like most of 9th edition and all of 10th, Chaos Knights is pretty much just you run as many war dogs as you can. So the armiger sized Chaos Knights. And just go to town and you pretty much don't run a big knight, which is kind of lame. But it's kind of the best way that that army works. And this is competitively, of course, competitively speaking.
Yeah.
And then Imperial Knights do run a decent mix. It's just unfortunately, because of that whole Bondsman change, they're just not as good as they were at the beginning of 10th edition and maybe should be. But that's very much an opinion-based question, too.
Yeah,
but yeah, like their goal though is that you would have kind of like essentially the concept and goal would be for every big knight you would give them two little knights, right? That would be the concept. And so like in probably like the brainchild of what GW truly want, right, or maybe would want or should want, is that you would maybe have like one or two, probably one of the, you know, the big heavy knights in the Dominus. And then, you know, you maybe would switch between having Questorus or Cerastus. Cerastus is more points, so you'd maybe like have one Cerastus or whatever. And then which for every one of those, you can maybe get two armigers. And you just try to balance around that, right? Trying to get that comp. Because then you would have big knight, two little knights, they bondsmen with each other, and then you go to town, right? That would be like the goal. They're just not doing that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately. but the other thing that can be confusing about collecting knights is if you want Chaos Knights, you'll only ever see the Knight Abominant box. But say you want, you know, the knight that's on the cover of the Codex. You wouldn't get that from the Abominant box. And the reason being is that what they used to do, the original way of doing Chaos Knights, because technically as a faction, Chaos Knights launched at the same time as Imperial Knights. But what they did is they expected you to buy the Imperial Knight, you know, Questorus and Dominus boxes, but then just paint them with Chaos colors. And then putting like the spikes and chains and other stuff was essentially just on you to like 3D print or find stuff to homebrew kit bash or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
which was kind of the lame, but that's how GW works. Essentially, if you're Chaos, you kind of get the half-assed approach. But then again, they finally did then launch the Night Abominant. They also, and then the War Dogs themselves also have their own kit, which is kind of cool because they have a bunch of extra heads and stuff, and like they have their own claw weapons. It's actually funny because like from a like loadout option standpoint, War Dogs are so much better than Armigers. Armigers only get either, you can either build them as the two with the autocannons, or the melt to chainsword combo, and that's it. Those are your two options. Where War Dogs, you get a lot of options. And I don't know, I think everything that's Chaos generally looks cooler too, but that's obviously a personal opinion. but like being able to actually literally have like a dog bone headed knight is really cool. So that is kind of the state of the Chaos Knights, though, where like you're also going generally very War Dog heavy. But other than that, yeah, I mean, like I said, as it stands, you're generally like obviously get whatever knight you want. But they're great painting projects. They're just like, especially like obviously they're expensive on their own, but you're collecting less models. So sometimes, especially if you like think of them MSRP, they actually are kind of one of the cheaper models to get, the or like armies to build. The yeah. downside though is if you're like me and obviously like to go secondhand market a lot, you're gonna have a tougher time, especially in like local options. So you're gonna really need to like use forums, use mini swap, you know, or really connect with local play groups and stuff to right. see who maybe isn't wanting to continue with their knights. All right, well, that'll do it for our knights, our nightly discussion. We'll tune in next week. We're going to come back to some more lore. And again, stay tuned. We'll be doing that live stream episode or quote-unquote episode where we'll be playing the game. The VOD will be available on our YouTube channel here on Natural One Media. But other than that, thank you so much for watching and or listening. Make sure to do all those fun YouTube pleasantries or share this podcast with a friend. Other than that, we'll see you next time.
Goodbye.